sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On this upcoming 18th anniversary, we're going to discuss 9/11, of course, and the official story of 9/11 falls apart no matter where you look at it, whether it's the World Trade Center towers, Shanksville, the Pentagon, the hijackers, the wars, the anthrax, all of it. If you look at it, there is no evidence to back up what the government is telling us, and lots of evidence to show that it's not true what they're saying. The mountain of evidence that has been gathered by 9/11 researchers over the last 18 years indicates strongly that 9/11 was a false flag event. And we'll talk more about that later. Today I'm joined in the studio by three 9/11 truth seekers to discuss much of this evidence. First, I'm joined by Gregory Longo, who was a Vietnam veteran, an anti-war activist, and has studied 9/11 since it happened. He did a radio show in West Ely, Rhode Island on 9/11 and related issues for 15 years. Gregory Longo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl.
And I'm also joined by Frank Tolupko, who is a 9/11 researcher and former radio show host on 9/11 in the Berkshires. Frank, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here again.
Yes, thank you for joining me again.
What goes on with this?
I'm also joined by Carl Seeger Henry, who's a local musician and who co-wrote the song Building 7, The Smoking Gun, which I play frequently on the show. He also appears on a local radio station talking about all of these issues, and he's known there as Conspiracy Carl. So, Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to be asking a series of questions about that evidence, and my wonderful guest will be answering them. And I invite you, the listeners, to also see if you know the answers to these questions yourself. So again, 9/11 falls apart no matter where you look at it, and that's what we're going to show you today. I'd like to start with the question, why is 9/11 still important these 18 years later?
Well, every time we have some event that involves foreign wars or whatever, we're always reminded about, you know, the smoking gun, you know, is going to be a mushroom cloud, etc., and if we don't act, we're going to have another 9/11. That seems to be burnt into the minds of people, and that's sort of the fear factor. But the point is, if we can show that that, in fact, was a self-inflicted wound to gain some other ends, that might, in fact, take away that ability to scare people.
I would also add that the magnitude of the event was so tremendous, and the way it was staged and the whole operation had an undeniably searing effect on the psyches of all of us Americans and actually throughout the world. So it was a very effective false flag attack with its intent of really kind of controlling the mindset and the opinions of the population.
Also, it's 18 years later. My grandson, who just entered college today, as a matter of fact, actually heard the planes when he was 5 months old going down 6th Avenue. But that's a whole new generation that's coming up now that didn't live through it, didn't see the TV stuff. They see it in retrospect, but they didn't experience it that day. My daughter is still terrified about that. She was working in New York. But they've got to come up with something new for the new generations that actually didn't go through the trauma of those days and weeks and months, etc. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's important to show why a false flag operation could be, again, affected. And we've got to try to educate people to fight against that or be very aware of it and not be taken in.
And this may be a good time to let the listeners know, what is a false flag operation?
I think the term originated when pirates were intent on committing larceny on the open seas, and in an attempt to sneak up closer to their prey, they flew a flag that was of another country's origin. So that the people they were about to hijack thought that they were a friendly ship. And it wasn't until they got close enough that they realized that they had hoisted a false flag and they weren't friendly at all, but they were pirates there to loot them.
So in the case of 9/11, it's that whoever perpetrated 9/11, and we have some ideas about that, but are blaming it on someone who actually didn't do it.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I think other examples from history, in England they talk about remember the 5th of November. That was a false flag operation because it was a fight between the Protestants and the Catholics there, and they made somebody do something that was from the other side. I mean, like what the German Nazis did before invading Poland, they dressed up some prisoners of war in Polish uniforms and made them attack the German forces, and they said, we're being attacked, but it really was their own people attacking them.
Right.
And they inflicted some mayhem upon the German soldiers, but then that was the excuse to go in and take over the western half of Poland.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically a setup to blame someone else for something.
Right.
Okay.
I think the powers that be needed something along the lines or the magnitude of the JFK assassination, which I consider a false flag event. You know, the RFK was probably not to that level, but they need something like 9/11. And I don't think the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center would live up to something they needed.
Yeah.
No, it was very interesting because there was a court trial and there are court records about it. The so-called blind sheikh, that was his name, of Oman Abdel Rahman, was in Jersey City, and he was from Egypt and all that, and we actually let him into the country, and he was a known terrorist in Egypt, and Egypt didn't particularly want him. So he gathered some people here that we supported, actually, by bringing them here, and we had an informant within the group.
This guy, when you say we, you mean the FBI?
I mean the government. The FBI had an informant within the group in this Jersey City conclave by the name of Imad Salem. So in the court record of the trial of after the event of the blind sheikh, he testifies, the informant, that he was told that they were going to stop it before it actually occurred. And while they did have explosives available, they were going to substitute talcum powder, etc. And he kept calling the FBI up and saying, when are you going to do the substitution? When are you going to do the substitution? It's in the court records. Mm-hmm. And it never happened, and therefore six people died. There were explosions, etc. But the FBI actually supplied the explosives. So that's a false flag. And get somebody else to do it, and then we can start that whole thing about, oh, the Arabs did it, these Muslims did it, etc. But it was the FBI that provided the means by bringing people here, as well as the explosives that they used.
Right. So an entrapment, in a way. And some of the other reasons I think 9/11 is still important is because we've lost our civil liberties based on the events of 9/11. We're into all these wars. We have into financial ruin because of all the money we're spending on that with no end in sight. And we also have had an executive power grab after 9/11, where presidents can take us to war and Congress has given up their abilities to stop them. All right, next question, true or false? The CIA created the term conspiracy theory to discredit anyone challenging the Warren Commission report on the JFK assassination.
True.
Anyone want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think they knew that the Kennedy assassination would raise a tremendous amount of questions. People were skeptical right from the start. And when the Warren Commission finally released their report, the CIA kind of instructed their people in the mainstream media to use the term conspiracy theorists and hammer that home repeatedly with the intent of using it so that anybody that questioned the official story about anything was a conspiracy theorist, which was, they tried to frame it as a very derogatory thing to say about somebody. And as soon as you label somebody that, they would automatically kind of disqualify anything that that person had to say that might have been factual.
I might add that the chronology was not perhaps as tight as you're indicating. I think what happened was when the Warren Commission report and its, you know, smaller version was released, they thought it was a slam dunk. Everybody's going home. Okay, please move on. There's nothing to see here. But when questions began to be raised, books began to be written about the contradictions in the official story, the CIA, and it shows from so many FOIA requests, the releases, that they became very concerned about that. So they couldn't really answer those contradictions. So what they had to do was smear the people pointing out the contradictions, and they then came out with this whole thing of, you're a conspiracy theorist, it's a conspiracy theory, the Warren Commission is the last word. I mean, we had all these experts testifying, etc. So yeah, you are correct in terms of that. But I don't think that that was thought about initially, because they thought it was going to be a slam dunk.
Yeah, it was after all the backlash and skepticism that they came up with it.
Right.
And I might add, that's one of the most effective campaigns I think the CIA has ever run, because it's being used constantly all the time. And now we're almost 20 years later, well, from the Kennedy assassination, we're talking about 45 years since it came up. And it's a tried and true method of them kind of controlling opposing opinions.
Right. And so if anyone falls for that and actually labels us conspiracy theorists, they're kind of doing the bidding of the CIA unwittingly.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
It's still out there in terms of 9/11, and they became very worried about it. especially during the Obama administration. One of the friends of Obama was this guy, Cass Sunstein, and he was talking about cognitive infiltration. So he's saying that, interestingly enough, he contradicts himself because he does say some conspiracy theories are true. In fact, the official story is a conspiracy theory.
Right.
Because it's people getting together, a group of people getting together for nefarious purposes. So it is a conspiracy theory. He says not only should we fight against them, but we should infiltrate and stop people from doing that. He doesn't say how. There's many ways of stopping them and actually infiltrating and doing other things to stop them. So that's another thing
that
you alluded to before about losing our right to privacy, our right to express our opinions, etc.
Right, and we definitely are infiltrated. We've all seen examples of that. And so a false flag operation has certain characteristics to it, and one of them are drills. For many of these false flag events, there are drills going on. Were there drills going on 9/11?
Yes, there were. And people were coming into town the day before 9/11 from FEMA, et cetera, like they knew something was going on or they had planned to do drills.
Right, there were drills. And I think it's up to 46 or 7 drills, I've heard, that people have
not
identified
many, really?
On 9/11. Yeah.
The FAA flight controllers were saying when they were looking at their screens, and they had been told that there were going to be drills. And at one point during the actual events occurring, somebody was quoted as saying, and it was in the papers at all, that is this real time or is it live? They didn't know. They were totally confused with drills going
on. Right, because NORAD was having a drill also, which is why they say that the planes weren't available to intercept.
I mean, the London bombing, there was a drill going on that day.
Tell us about that. There was a drill that day.
Same idea.
It was the same time and the same location in the drill is where the actual bombs
Yeah, I mean, they had people on the BBC talking that morning and actually saying, the guy probably wasn't in the loop, but saying, we're planning a drill that day. Isn't it interesting? It just actually occurred as we're doing this drill.
Same location.
Out of like over 200 different stations on the line. It defies the odds, for certainly.
Yeah, for sure.
I think another aspect of false flags is the lack of any kind of a defense to what happens. Certainly in the case of 9/11, supposedly we have the most advanced military in the world, $1 trillion military, and that day there was nothing. There was zero. There was no defense at all, according to what happened. And I've read that I think the top 7, the military commanders, right as that event took place, they were all like out of communication. The cell phone died, one was in the dentist's office, all kinds of things prevented them from actually taking command when they would have been the next in line to take command in an emergency situation.
Well, that's part of the coincidence theory.
What a coincidence.
All right, so 9/11 wasn't the first time a false flag event has been carried out in the U.S. or anywhere else, and it won't be the last, unfortunately. Operation Gladio was an ongoing false flag operation in Europe. And can any of you tell me about that?
Actually, there's a very interesting book written on that. It's called NATO's Secret Armies, written by one Daniel Ganser, G-A-N-S-E-R, who writes about the stay-behind forces. What are the stay-behind forces? Well, after the end of the Second World War, where the Soviets took out much of Eastern Europe, gained control by treaty of Eastern Europe, not in Western Europe, but what we did is these former Nazis were left in place in many of these countries because we were actually contemplating a war with the Soviet Union at that point, since they were so weakened. That was the time. There were many people within the military saying, this is the time to get the Russians, this is the time to get them because they're weakened. And over the course of the next few decades, the 50s, 60s, 70s, many events like train bombings, etc., were being blamed on such groups as the Red Brigades in Germany, etc. As it turns out, if you read in the book, that it's called documented, that these people were actually being funded by the CIA and other organizations such as the CIA in Europe to create false flag events saying, oh, the communists did it, the communists did this, did that, when it really wasn't. It was done by people acting like them.
Right. And the book you mentioned by Daniel Ganser is a good one. And there's also another book. It's called Gladio, NATO's Dagger in the Heart of Europe, The Pentagon Nazi Mafia Terror Axis. And it's written by Richard Cottrell.
Does anybody here know that Benjamin Netanyahu was in one of those stations in the London system in a hotel when it was bombed?
He was in London, that's for sure. And I think he was there for a meeting. And I think he was told to go to a different place for the meeting. That's where I recall reading. Well, what was he doing in town? You know, What was George H.W. Bush doing in Dallas the day that Kennedy was killed? I mean, he first denied it and then said, no, it was here, it was there, and there, and then finally had to admit that he was there. So a lot of these things, they were there to observe it, to see what was going on.
I think another aspect of a false flag, successful false flag operation, is a complicit media. It's really important that the people that are reporting on it know what the official story is and just push that official story endlessly.
Right, and that's the first thing you hear, and it stays in your brain. And
exactly.
Then if you try and challenge people on what they think they know, it's very difficult.
And I think that's why the first 24 hours after any event like that, like 9/11 or Kennedy's assassination, the first reports are probably the most important, because nobody's really in on the game, the media, et cetera, and they're just reporting what they see. And that's really crucial information. It can be massaged later on. But that initial stuff, like somebody saying, oh, I was at the Pentagon, I didn't see any plane go in, I don't see any plane parts I like, and then he had to backtrack a couple of years later saying, well, I didn't really say that, but that's what he initially said.
Right.
Or somebody is standing at the World Trade Center, like a Willie Rodriguez, who was the head maintenance supervisor, saying that he heard explosions in the building before the first plane had been hit. And that was in the press, and in fact, he was with George Bush and got an award for that, later to be disparaged because it disproved the whole official story.
I would agree with Carl. I'd say the media, if they're not in on it, they have been given the warning that this is going to happen, and it's explicit to the high-level media. I mean, even for 9/11, Al Franken was told by Mayor Ed Koch of New York
not to go
to work that day in the World Trade Center where Al Franken was working, not to go to work that day. It's in page 104 of Franken's book, The Lies and Lying Liars.
Koch was not mayor at the time. Giuliani was. Former mayor.
Former mayor.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Now, then that means that Koch knew. So he's complicit in aiding and abetting a felony.
Did anyone in the media pick up on Franken's statement in his book and investigate that? I doubt it.
Getting back to another point that Frank made, yeah, you're right, because that first day that it happens, there are people in the media that didn't get the memo or a little bit off kilter, and they reported what they saw. So you have people like Dan Rather using words like controlled demolation.
Yeah, doesn't
the towers
it just
look just
like controlled
demolition?
Right.
Then a number of broadcasters and people up in helicopters, a lot of people use that term, controlled demolition, and on September 12th, the term controlled demolition disappeared from media. Nobody used that term anymore.
I got another example I can give you of that first 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Very interesting story, which I took notes on. This is from what I was getting into. This is from notes I took in September 15th in 2006. A guy by the name of Van Romero was the vice president for research at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, right? And he was the former director of Energetic Materials Research and Testing. And energetic materials are explosives. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So he was asked. I guess he was the go-to guy. He's asked on September 12th, the next day, and it was a report in the Albuquerque Journal. And he was asked about what he saw about those buildings, because he's an expert in explosives, and an expert in construction, etc. And his comment was, there were some explosive devices in the buildings that caused the towers to collapse. It was too methodical. He's actually quoted as saying that. And this is a top guy. He's not some left-wing crazy or something like that. All right. So then, a couple of weeks later, on September 21st, in the Albuquerque Journal, he's now quoted as saying, certainly the fire is what caused the building to collapse, he says. And he goes on, subsequent conversations with, and he's asked why he came to that conclusion, why it was so different. He says, well, I had subsequent conversations with structural engineers. I took a more detailed look at what was going on. I'm not saying that anything did or did not happen, though. Okay, so we go to the next month on the 5th of October. The Wall Street Journal names the New Mexico Institute of Technology as the fall's hot school to go to, a really great place to go, on the basis of location, research, and counterterrorism, and scholarship money available. And we go on a little further to the next year, a year later. There's an announcement from the college saying that the Department of Justice has just awarded the college $15 million to provide two terrorism preparedness courses for first responders. It goes on. Then in 2003, there's another announcement from the college. The Influence magazine tapped Van Romero as one of the six lobbyists who made an impact in 2003 among D.C. lobbyists. So he's getting paid money to do his lobbying. From 2,000 miles away, he did all this great work. So the guy was bought off.
Right.
How he changed his story. So what he said in the first 24 hours was what he actually saw. And then he gets bought off, mm-hmm. and the story changes. That's how it works.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. And then the opposite of that is we have reporters saying that Building 7 was going to fall before it actually did. And how would they know that? And
there were reports as early as 10:30 in the morning on ABC TV, and they've saved the tapes from that, where he said, we've got reports that another building, Building 7, the Salomon Brothers building, is about to collapse or has collapsed or whatever. Of course, that was Scotch, and then we went later on to 4:30 in the afternoon when
Jane Stanley, anyone?
On BBC TV.
Well, she was standing in their studio with the picture of Building 7 standing behind her, and she's reported that it already collapsed, and it was standing behind. You could see it hadn't. It didn't collapse for, I think, 20 more minutes. So the question is, how did she know? And Carl, you have some information.
I think she actually mentioned it twice. It was like something like 5:06, and then about 10 minutes later, she again reported that the Salomon building had collapsed when she was standing right in front of the feed from New York. And I think the follow-up on Jane Stanley and the BBC is, of course, as often happens in these cases, as soon as people started questioning it, wouldn't you know it, all the master tapes of the BBC, everything kind of got erased or disappeared. There was no record of it whatsoever.
That's why it's important to watch and tape and record everything from that
beginning
day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's why so many citizen activists and journalists are making a point of doing that, because a lot of times things disappear. A day or two later, all the evidence is gone. But you can actually see Jane Stanley making this famous announcement. I think afterwards, too, it was curious because the guy who was the anchor that was asking the questions that day, he actually conceded that, I think his quote was, well, maybe the conspiracy theorists have a point. Because he was asked about, well, how did Jane Stanley know? How did she know? And he kind of acknowledged that it could have been something that was questionable. And apparently everybody was tracking down Jane Stanley, and they were bombarding her with questions. Now, she's just a reporter. I'm not saying she had anything to do with it, but
she happened to be in the
wrong place at the wrong time.
Somebody fed information.
Sure, somebody gave her that information.
Somebody cut off the feed from the New York to the BBC back in London, where you see it goes it goes into all pixelated stuff and drops out. My thing is that the reporter back in London at some point later point said, oh, it was a big cock-up. It was a mess-up and stuff. It was all the confusion, you know, the fog of war, et cetera. But you're saying that he actually admitted that that's okay, great.
I think he actually at one point actually kind of acknowledged that, and I think that he termed it that way, maybe the conspiracy theorists have a point. The other thing I think that was kind of a sad footnote to it is that Jane Stanley quickly disappeared from the scene. I mean, imagine the pressure she was under to have to try to answer these questions. And my research indicates that she basically became a missionary in Africa and just kind of totally left England, and she just wanted to disappear.
Oh, you know,
that's what I heard.
Since we're on Building 7, there was somebody else that was in that building. Barry Jennings, along with Mr. Hess, that worked for Giuliani, had some interesting things to say, and he's disappeared also. We don't know. They say that he died, but some mysterious. He came out and said that there were massive explosions going on within the building. Because they had gone into the building when they heard it, because all the higher-up officials within the Giuliani administration were told to come down there to assist, etc. And they actually go into Building 7, and they go up to the control center, which was, what, the 23rd floor or whatever? And nobody's there. Everybody's gone. And they call up, and then they were told, get out of there. And as they're trying to leave the building, they were trapped because there were explosions going off way before the building collapsed and way before any of the other towers collapsed. And within the first 24 minutes after he gets rescued from the building, he gives a report saying this, what was going on, which is very important, the first 24 hours. And, of course, he stuck to his story. Later on, he's taken to the hospital and supposedly had a heart attack. But when they go to see, the whole family house had been emptied and moved away. So he may, in fact, be in some sort of witness protection program.
He was actually spoke in one of the Loose Change movies about 9/11, said his piece about what happened, and he was stepping over dead bodies, he said, in Building 7. And I think the official story is that nobody died in that building. And he said it was, you know, explosions, stepping over dead bodies.
Right.
And then after the movie came out, he was then disappeared.
Well, we don't know. But it's very interesting in the circumstances. The guys that made Loose Change actually made a few bucks off the movie, which is okay, but they hired a private detective to try to track him down. the private detective came back and says, I'm off this. I'm off this. Here's your money back. So there was something going on there that's fishy. My feeling in it, it's strictly, this is a conspiracy theory. He's still alive and he's some sort of protection program. That was the payoff, etc. To be hounded like that, that's a terrible thing. I can't, you know, you can't criticize somebody for that, but you don't know what pressure they're under.
Okay, so let's start with some more questions here. So we've already discussed that the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was a false flag, and it was helped out by the FBI. All right, so who created Al-Qaeda?
Well, what does Al-Qaeda mean?
The database.
Right? Yeah. So I think we got together with Brzezinski and some of the power structure got together and said, we need some Muslim hotheads to do our dirty work. And that's what we created. And we had a list of people that we could get among them, people like Osama bin Laden, etc., which were in the database.
Right. And didn't we create them to fight the Russians when the Russians had invaded Afghanistan?
Interesting. I was at a press conference with Brzezinski, and that's what he claims, is that we got a coalition of countries together to go into Afghanistan and get them to fight against the Russians, etc. But that's not what other people have said, including the head of the Defense Department, etc. We sent in people like Osama bin Laden and create mayhem there because it was a government that had friendly relations at that point with the Soviet Union. And we were causing all kinds of mayhem there. So we were actually there. So Russians came in afterwards. So it's not that the Russians came in and then we did that. We were trying to draw them in. And the actual plan, and Brzezinski says that, the actual plan was to give them their Vietnam and try to bankrupt the government, which was fairly successful because 10 years later, the government was in dire economic trouble, just like we were after the Vietnam War with all the money that we had spent. And we also wanted to control the area because we're talking about pipelines going through Afghanistan, etc. Mm-hmm. So,
right. So if you put that information together, that we helped create Al-Qaeda for our own reasons, and then we had Osama bin Laden, whose CIA name was Tim Osman, and then you look at that the alleged hijackers weren't really on the planes and some of them are still alive, you kind of have to really rethink your thoughts of 9/11, I would think. You've just been listening to the first part of a discussion with Gregory Longo, Frank Tolupko, and Carl Seeger Henry on the evidence that contradicts the official story of what happened on 9/11. Tune in next week to hear the continuation of this discussion. And to learn more about the anniversary events coming up this month, and most likely this weekend and next week, you can go to the website ae911truth.org. So ae911truth.org. And look under events, and you should see all the things that are going on in New York, Washington, and Europe. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. And I'll end the show with a few minutes of Carl Seeger Henry's song, Building 7, The Smoking Gun. And here it is.
Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth by what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth, it tells it true. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. At the World Trade Center, three buildings came down, hit by two planes, panic all around. But Building 7 had barely a scratch, not hit by a plane, yet it still collapsed. And office fires were blamed for that. Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth, it tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. The first responders saw molten steel. They heard explosions, swore they were real. And we all watched just seemed surreal. Those buildings fell with roaring blast. A demolition controlled and fast. Building 7, the smoking gun, it tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7.